Joint Conference Committee on Senate Bill 130. It is Saturday, May 21st. All members of the conference committee, Senators Huggin, myself, Terrio, and French are here, along with their House members, Croft, Anderson, and Roakberg. I'd like to start off with R.27. I'd like to label that as Amendment Number 10, and I will move that at this time.
Object.
There's objection, like Mr. Lazinski and Chris Knutson, to come forward to answer questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roakberg.
While they're coming up here, I just wanted to make a point that we will be having a follow-up amendment to remove some of the language which is omitted from this amendment, just so it's understood on the record.
Yes, and we'll deal with that. It's a modification to Section 66 of the bill. I'll be moving that as Amendment Number 11. There's objection to the amendment. Representative Croft, I'd like to speak to your objection.
I thought we established yesterday you speak to the amendment, but I'd like to understand more about what it does.
Okay. Chris, why don't we have you go through? This language was developed this morning in conjunction with Ms. Knutson.
Thank you. Representative Croft, through the chair. The first part of the amendment through in arising out of it in the course of a presumption may be rebutted by a demonstration of substantial evidence. Through that part, it is essentially an encapsulation of what the current law is with respect to how the operation of the presumption works.
Through what line? I'm sorry.
Through line 13.
So 4 through 13, I'm sorry.
Are essentially an encapsulation of how the current law works. In other words, in order to establish the presumption under A1, 120A1, that an injury is covered by the Workers' Compensation Act in the sense of being compensable under the Act, that payment may be made for it, we have to establish some slight connection, work connection, to the employment. Once that presumption is in place, an employer has the obligation to rebut the presumption with substantial evidence that's not work-related. They can do that in two ways. It's very well established in law how they can rebut the presumption. The next sentence is new. It's determined when determining whether or not the death or disability or need for medical treatment arose out of and in the course of employment, the board must evaluate the relative contribution of the different causes of disability or death. It's new only in the sense that what it is a directive to the board that when they're determining whether or not the work is a substantial cause of the injury, that they have to do it in relation to all the other causes. In other words, instead of viewing it solely in isolation when you're determining whether or not work is a substantial factor, instead of determining it solely in isolation looking only at the work, you also look at the other things to determine substantiality. It's really the way it's supposed to work, but sometimes doesn't. That when you determine whether or not something is substantial, that you look at everything and determine, kind of do this little comparison and say, okay, is it substantial or not?
Question on that point.
Yes.
Go ahead, Senator French.
Could you explain it as clearly as you possibly can how it's done now? And that way I can compare it with this language so I know how we're going to do it in the future.
Okay. How it is done now is that assuming that the presumption has dropped out, okay, you look at the work and you say, but for the work, would this injury have occurred? That's the first part of the substantial factor test. And is it so important in bringing about the harm, the disability or need for medical treatment, that reasonable men would regard it as a cause and assign responsibility to it?
That's
it's in looking
that's
at
the substantial factor test.
That's the substantial factor test. in looking at whether or not reasonable men would regard it as a cause and assign responsibility to it is kind of a soft and fluid thing, but that's the test for proximate cause that we're all lawyers in the state are familiar with, legal cause. And this doesn't alter that in any way. It just says that when you're looking at whether or not something is substantial, that to gauge substantiality, you also have to look at what the other things out there are.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm not trying to compare to yesterday's amendment, but the reason I think this was brought back is it's a hybrid of what we're trying to get to, and I can pallet more. To the questions that were just asked, under this scenario with this amendment, looking at, and I agree that the first part, and I looked it up before we came to the meeting, the first section 4 through 13 is essentially a reiteration of what we already have, and it's lines 14 through 20 that really would make a difference. A big difference, I don't know, but a difference. The difference is that if there's an issue on the substantial cause, now it reverts to the board to determine. And that would probably be because employers are like, well, wait, I don't want to play. The second employer might say, I'm not the substantial cause. And the first employer might say, well, I'm not the substantial cause. And maybe the insurer from a sports injury would say, I'm not the substantial cause. And the board says, wait a minute. We're going to look at that per this amendment. By law now, we have to look at that and determine where is the substantial cause. Where did it emanate from? Was it from your current job of lifting the coffee beans, or was it from your football injury, or was it from your job on the oil fields? And isn't that the reason we're articulating this more? I mean, you can't go to the reason. You're just here to obviously articulate what it says. But isn't that the difference? That there would be even a more compelling reason for the board to look at this. So it's more scrutiny on where's the cause, who's going to pay.
Yes, that is the second change. The first one is really not much of a change, because in determining substantiality, determining whether or not the injury, the presumption has been overcome, they have to look. An employer will bring forward evidence of other causes. But that's a very... That really doesn't impact whether or not the bar, if you will, for recovery of workers' comp has been changed. The second sentence, as you have said, Representative Anderson, excuse me, through the chair, exactly pinpoints the second difference, and that's the more significant difference.
And then just second question, Mr. Chair, quick follow-up. Let's get into it. Let's get into the debate. A substantial versus the substantial. A substantial, I would say that the percentage would be 70, 80, 90% of the time that if the measure is the current A substantial, the current employer would have to pay. And that's one of the reasons for, I think, the debate on this bill is who covers the injury. The injury will be covered, but who covers it? I mean, at minimum, Medicaid will cover it. So the worker generally, I haven't heard of where, I was talking to someone earlier, a knee is ripped out or a back is hurt and someone just sits there. I mean, they're going to be covered.
What about lost wages?
Well, but let me, you can get to that in a second. So looking at this, won't this afford more scrutiny on coverage? I mean, isn't that the bottom line, these last two sentences? That's why I'm compelled to vote for the amendment. Could you answer that?
It does require that the board expand its scrutiny. That is correct, the second to the last. They can do it now. Nothing prohibits them from doing it now, except it may be sometimes habit of not looking at everything when they're determining whether something's substantial or not. There's nothing that prevents them from doing this. The second to the last sentence, if you will, lines 14 through 17, the beginning of 17. That does not represent anything other than simply a directive to the board that when they're looking at determining whether something's either a substantial factor or the substantial factor, that they look at everything instead of just focusing on one.
Representative Croft.
What's the statute of limitations in compensation?
It's a very good question, through the chair, Representative Kropft. The statute of limitations is 2 years after the date of injury, but no longer than 4 years after the date of injury, except if it's a latent injury, and then it's after the determination of discovery, and in the case of death, it's 1 year. But the statute of limitations does not begin to run until the person is aware of a connection between the disability or need for medical treatment and the work. In other words, it doesn't even begin to run until discovery. The statute of limitations is quite lengthy, really.
2 years from when I knew or reasonably should have known that of the injury and the connection to the employment.
Right.
Yesterday, through the chair, thank you, we were talking about cases where it was part of what Mr. Lysenki was using, that this can be unfair because you have a number of employments that contribute, either because you're breathing the same toxins or you're getting the same asbestos or you're doing the same repeated movement that does carpal tunnel, and that you can spend 4 years on this job and 8 years on the next and a year or two in the following. And is it fair to have that last employer whose employment did contribute to it but may not have been the major? As long as we were in a substantial cause, you knew that if the employment contributed in a substantial way to that injury, that employee would be covered. Can't you get under this the same problem we were discussing yesterday? The difference between a substantial and the substantial cause, I can say your employment contributed to your injury. It was a substantial cause. But you worked before that 8 years in the ripping asbestos out. That was probably a more substantial cause. If it always has to be that the last employer is the one with the biggest of the contributing factors, aren't you going to have a lot of workers who are genuinely injured on the job, genuine connection between their employment and that injury, who just fall through on these cracks? Explaining to an employee how we know the asbestos caused your cancer, we know you're going to die of this cancer, but your last employment wasn't quite the biggest. You know, it was the 8 years you spent ripping it out of the naval shipyards. Isn't there that danger that you get employees under this formulation falling through the cracks where you did not before?
Through the chair, Senator Kropft.
Don't demote me. I'm just a representative.
I'm sorry. Representative Kropft, I apologize. The crack here is much narrower.
I was saying you wish you could be a senator.
Much narrower than than I think you would have experienced with major contributing factor. A substantial cause and the substantial cause do represent, there is a distinction that was drawn by our Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has not indicated, that I am aware of, that the substantial cause is necessarily equivalent to something as the major contributing cause. But there is a distinction, and it has been recognized by our Supreme Court.
But it's a much lower standard than the major contributing cause.
In my estimation, when you're talking about the substantial cause, you're talking about the allowance of there being many causes, and the substantial cause being whatever constitutes substantial in the minds of reasonable men, the substantial cause. It's not, in my sense, a comparative expression that major necessarily implies. Major means that you must compare it and determine that it is the highest, if you will.
So a lower threshold is the substantial. Obviously, we wouldn't have the amendment back.
But it's not to say that it's the same as we currently have.
Yeah, it's higher.
Representative Croft, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. But there's a lot of language of comparison in this amendment. We clearly do. It's hard to say the difference, or hard to me to get my head around the difference between A and the, because the amendment clearly contemplates you're comparing it one against the other.
And the amendment, excuse me if I may respond to
you. Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Croft. The first sentence clearly contemplates that substantiality would be determined in comparison to other causes, if other causes exist. And that is, in fact, the way the Supreme Court has determined substantial factor to be originally, if you go all the way back to Abbott and Sharp versus Fairbanks, North Star Borough, that they said we're going to look at this when you have two competing causes. And it is necessarily substantial factor or substantial cause is a comparative analysis. We tend perhaps to have forgotten that, tend to perhaps have been forgotten in the analysis of work relationship. All this does is say to the board, the second to the last sentence, say to the board, look, when you're determining if it's substantial, you've got to determine substantiality in relation to what? In relation to an ideal, in relationship to what? And they're saying you have to determine substantiality in relation to other causes.
Okay, so you can't be the substantial cause under this amendment if something is more of a cause, if something else is more of a cause. If there's something a little bit higher, you're not the, you may be a substantial, but you're not the substantial cause anymore if something, you're 19 and something's 23 or whatever.
Through the chair, Senator Croft, I mean, Representative Croft, you are correct.
Then back to that situation that still troubles me. Somebody works 12 years ripping asbestos out, goes to the new job and is starting to work, works there a total of five. In the middle of that, they start to feel sick. Towards the end of that, they start to know that it's related to their work, and maybe they should have known all the time as much as is out. And they finally get so sick, they keep trying to work, finally get so sick they cannot work. Come in and they say, well, it's related to your work, you're gonna die of it, but your 5 years here probably isn't the substantial, it's a substantial. 12 years that you did before was, but you can't sue them because it's been 2 years since you should have known, you kept on working, kept on trying. Doesn't nobody pay in that situation under the substantial cause?
Through the chair, Senator, Representative Croft, I do apologize.
Yeah, it's a grievous insult, but I know you don't mean it.
I don't believe that that would be the case, and there is a reason for that. This amendment was drafted in the disjunctive, and what that means is that you have to look at whether or not the disability at the time that the claim is filed or the need for medical treatment at the time the claim is filed was occasioned by the employment. If a person, even though they had had 8 years of exposure in a shipyard, as you were positing, has nonetheless continued to be employable and has not experienced any symptoms, I would think that a subsequent employer would have a very difficult time establishing that the need for medical treatment was not, that the latest employment was not the substantial factor in the need for medical treatment at that time, because it's the need for medical treatment at the time of the end of the last employment. It's the disability at the time, that temporary disability while they're getting the medical treatment. I don't see that as an impossibility. What you're, I think, reaching more to is, well, what about later on? I if you remember what the employer's burden is unchanged. The employer still has to eliminate the possibility that of work relationship as defined here. The employer has to eliminate that possibility through substantial evidence, or they have to point to another cause that would eliminate, if accepted, would eliminate the possibility. In other words, and it's an exclusive clause. The employer has to point to another cause and say, that one is so strong that it excludes me as a legal cause. That part is unchanged. You don't even go to where you're at unless you can overcome the presumption. The way you overcome the presumption is unchanged.
Identical in the first part of A down to line 13 to current law.
To current law. It is not changed. You still must show by substantial evidence that you have excluded the current employment as the cause.
On that point, the current law is that an employee has to show some evidence, and then the employer has to show substantial
evidence that excludes the employment as a legal cause of the injury, and it has to exclude all reasonable possibility negatively or affirmatively point to another cause which, if accepted, would exclude the possibility that it's work-related.
Where is that language, some evidence, and then where is the language of excluding any other in this 13, 1 through 13?
It's a matter of state case law. There's been many Supreme Court cases, and I can point to a couple of them.
Oh, where is it? We're about to codify case law in the statute, and if we don't put it in, it ain't there. Where do we say some evidence? Where do we say excluding? I mean, we established the causal link and left out some evidence, which seems...
It says they must establish a causal link, and that's the wording from Steffi, I believe, was the case. It's a causal link. It doesn't mean that they have to make out an entire prima facie case. They have to establish some slight evidence of linkage.
Line 12. No.
Neither the initial employee statement nor the burden on the employer is identical in my, from looking at the case law this morning to what we have. We're making... There's a big difference between establishing a causal link and submitting some evidence of a causal link. There's a big difference between the way you there accurately phrased the burden on the employer once you've established that and what this says.
This says that the presumption may be rebutted by a demonstration of substantial evidence that the death or disability did not arise out of and in the course of employment. The way you do that is through the demonstration of evidence that excludes the reasonable possibility or is affirmative evidence that points to another cause that would exclude the reasonable possibility that you're work-related, of regulation, work-relatedness. I apologize through the chair.
Representative Croft, before you go any further, I'm sorry. We just got the corrected amendment back, so I'd like to, instead of deal with things in a two-step process, the new members should have R28. R28. That includes, if you look on page 2, the deletion of the language in section 66. It deletes the stress issue with regards to the separate tort claim. So I'd like to, at this time, withdraw R27, and I will then offer R28. As amendment number 11, let's just give it a new number just to keep things clean so that we've got the combined memo or amendment together and we won't have to deal with things in a two-step process. So
you didn't do it as new 10, you did it as 11?
Let's do it as 11, yeah. So I think, though, that the your line of questioning, though, can just pick up the section that you're questioning is not changed, so.
Chris, if...
And I assume that you object to the adoption of new 11.
Yeah, but we may be... yes, for now, yeah. If I added on line 10, must establish some evidence of a causal link between the employment and the disability, I mean, your point's well taken on the other. The overall general legal standard is substantial evidence, and then there's a lot of case law that fleshes it out. But you, I think you, this accurately sort of states that standard. But I'm worried that it doesn't accurately state the current law on the original burden of the employee. And that we could misread a full causal link with the current standard we have of some evidence of, and then the employer comes in and rebuts.
It's preponderance. Excuse me, if I might. Eric, it's preponderance evidence for the employee, I think, and the change is substantial evidence. That's what the Stiefel case says.
Well, I know that working with Senator Seekins this morning, this language came right out of the published court's decision. We were trying to be very careful to pattern the language actually after what the court said. So
it's down to line 13. And after that, it's new.
That's right. Yes.
Through the chair, in response to Representative Croft, it is described as a causal link in meaning a link, not the whole case. In Steffi, it's described variously as a preliminary link.
Preliminary.
And in, for example, Smallwood, it's described as, you know, some evidence of work connection. It's variously described, but causal link is directly out of a Supreme Court case discussing the whole, in Steffi, discussing the whole preliminary link is also used.
And sometimes some evidence.
And sometimes some evidence of.
And whether we put it in or not, you guys, this language doesn't mean to harm those line of cases, the preliminary or the some evidence, it's still that same idea.
Through the chair, exactly.
Thank you for now, Mr. Chair.
Senator French, did you have a question?
Just as maybe as sort of a more global look at the section that we're talking about, that's section A of the new 2310.010, lines 1 through 13, existing case law, just codifies existing case law. Lines 14 through 20, though, takes that existing coverage and squeezes it smaller.
To be exact, through the chair, Senator French, it would not squeeze it smaller, 14 through 17, the first word of 17. Has no impact whatever on squeezing, if you will. It's not at all intended in any way to restrict or limit or change in any way the current standard for work relationship.
Just directs the board. Well, it requires the board to
yes.
take that.
Something that they should be doing anyway.
But not doing now, right?
So if I were to write a letter to my constituents to try to describe to them what this section did, and I were to put this paragraph in the letter, would the letter be true? And the letter would say, this subsection is intended only to codify existing case law and does not change any right or remedy afforded employers or employees as of the passage of this act. Would that be true?
Through the chair, Senator French, I believe that I've already stated that the last sentence, the word the, does constitute a change from current law.
And so I guess I'm back to my first question, that is, does it take the universe of claims and squeeze it a little bit smaller such that now there's a certain number of claims that would have been covered under the old law and not be covered under the new law?
Through the chair, Senator French, it would be hard for me to come up with how it would happen, but I can foresee that it could.
The title of the newsletter should be Hero French Supports Amendment 11.
Senator French.
Whether I can write that or not. And I guess just to go one more question on this is, if I were to go to line 20 and change line 20 to say a substantial cause from the, I think the ball would be just the exact same size it was before. And it's the word A to V that really squeezes it smaller.
Through the chair, Senator French, you are exactly correct.
As far as not going for the major contributing cause, dropping back from that standard to codifying the existing, this is where there's a little bit of, there is a change to the current standard. It's in that last sentence. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Knutson, I think some of the concerns have been raised about the prior standard that we were contemplating and even this standard is that people will be left without coverage in the event that there's a finding either by the courts or the board that they won't qualify for workers' compensation benefits. And I'd like you, one of the areas of the concern is if there's insolvency. I think we have the insurance guarantee fund or the first employer versus second employer, or if there's a sports injury, then their health insurance should be looked at as a primary source of payment and things of that nature. I think this is part of what we're doing here, but do you believe this language here still represents a protection for employees, and will the last injurious exposure doctrine still survive this particular amendment, and how that would fit into practice with the board and in the real world?
Through the chair, Representative Roper. I don't think that this amendment in any way gets rid of the last injurious exposure doctrine. It doesn't affect the last injurious exposure doctrine. The amendment will provide an opportunity for employers to shift sometimes when they may have been a substantial factor to another employer who is the substantial factor. But as to initial treatment of injuries that occur on the job, it is hard for me to imagine a case where you have an injury that is a witnessed injury on the job, even if you have a pre-existing condition, where the need for medical treatment is clearly triggered by the job, that you would be not provided that treatment and disability incurred during that treatment.
Well, the 2331-55D clearly protects any worker. And then the worker's going to get paid.
What provision are you reading?
That's the statutory provision.
Oh, yes.
2331-55D, right. There's a dispute about who's paying. That's not, it shouldn't be a problem. The bill's paid by the current employer. Then subsequent to that, then there's some adjudicative process to determine where the fault lies, and that's the current law now.
2331-55D.
But that, I guess my concern is here, and what I want to follow up, Mr. Chairman, just real briefly, is the this issue of the substantial cause when you have an older injury. It seems to me that you can come up with a more typical fact pattern that would say that there was a pre-existing condition and that when an injury occurred on the employee's current job, that the nature of that injury was really the substantial factor that caused the injury. In other words, that latest injury, even though you could say, well, he's really got he's partially disabled, if you will, but it was a job that occurred at that time that the board could find was a substantial factor in making the award and assessing it to the current employer. And my question making sense to you there? It's the great issue.
Through the chair, Representative Roper, I think I've lost thread of the question.
Yeah, right. In other words, you talked earlier about the fact that the current injury could be the substantial factor, notwithstanding the fact that there would be a major pre-existing condition. That's what I'm getting at there.
Through the chair, Representative Roepberg, because this is phrased in the disjunctive, and that means the ors. Yes, you could have a situation where you have a pre-existing condition. Let us example, for example, say diabetes. You step on a nail at work. You need treatment immediately for that injury, that gash and stuff to your leg. Further down the road, and you get it. It's a major contributing. It's not major contributing. It's the substantial factor in the need for medical treatment. Your absence from work is covered. But later on down the road, you develop a diabetic neuropathy and ultimately have to have your leg, a toe or whatever amputated. Is at that point is where you would start to be looking at what is the substantial factor in the need for that kind of treatment.
Go ahead, Representative
Croft. Might be the prior employment. Might be the 10 years ago diabetic, and I might have to chase them down.
That is through the chair. That is correct.
I mean, and what about the statute of limits issue that Representative Croft brought up there? When we're looking back at an older pre-existing condition, is there any bar under the statute of limitations here because this length of time passes?
Through the chair, Representative Roepberg, the current statute of limitations makes provision for latent injuries,
okay. And
also makes provision for when you don't know the connection between the disability and the original injury. In other words, you have to look to the onset of the disability as the time triggering the statute of limitations.
Well, we'll just follow up on that, and then I want to ask about the disjunctive, if I can.
Go ahead.
I mean, I think you're being too modest about the cost savings of this provision. If it's simply a fight between which employer pays, this isn't going to save any money. In fact, it may cost money because we're going to have litigation over who's the substantial factor now. That we wouldn't have had before, but the overall compensation system is going to pay either way. The only way this saves money, and I believe it does, is by letting some of those injured workers drop out or be the victims in a fight between insurance companies. And so I do think this provision will save money because I do believe there are employees who will not get compensation for clearly a workplace injury and for clear harm because they're caught in a fight between who is the substantial factor. And you've said now a couple of times, and respect your knowledge of this area of the law, but true, you trigger when the disability turns into a disability or an injury. But the exposure, if I work 15 years in one yard and 5 in the next, I don't see how a rational doctor or court system can. I mean, it's exposure that causes the illness, injury, disability, and clearly, you said before in your testimony, when there are two causes and one is greater, the other cannot be the substantial cause anymore. It can be a substantial, it can no longer be the substantial. There's a significant, I don't see how a court can say anything but that the 15-year exposure is greater than the 5-year exposure. And having said that, even though I'm at work, I'm being exposed, I'm injured, and I'm going to die, I no longer have that claim that I had before. If there's any reason I can't go for my employer against my employer way back, they're just going to be left without. And it used to be that we had the compensation system itself carried that risk. And that risk is going to be shifted now to an employee who there's no question they had a work-related injury. But if they get caught between the two standards, it's them. And I think it's my main objection to this amendment. You keep saying the disjunctive. What am I missing what are you referring to on that?
Through the chair, Representative Croft. Mm-hmm. It's that compensation or benefits are payable under this chapter for disability or death or the need for medical treatment. In other words, that it contemplates that there may be occasions when, for example, the disability concerns whether it's temporary partial, temporary total, whatever, may not be work-related, but the need for medical treatment is. And so instead of reforcing the employee to prove that, to qualify by getting all of those things, it's disjunctive. You can
now
consider.
Now I understand. But that last sentence, it says or, but if. So compensation or benefits are payable for the disability or death or the need for medical treatment if it's the substantial cause. I can't get any one of the three unless I'm ahead of everybody else. I've got, you know, I'm a greater cause than anybody else.
Through the chair, I believe that I've stated this again and again. That's the difference between the and A.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there further questions? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote if the objection is maintained.
Yeah, it is.
On amendment number 11.
Yes.
Representative Croft?
No.
Representative
Roper?
Yes.
Senator
Hughes?
Yes.
Senator French?
No.
Senator
Terry? Yes. Amendment number 11 passes. And just to make it clear to everybody, the structural change in the new 2330.010 and the deletion on page 2 of the amendment of language in section 66 takes care of the argument that was made that there could be a separate tort action against the employer for those items that were exempted out of the definition of injury. So I know there were a number of members on the House that were concerned about that in particular, and that's been cured for the bill and also for the current statute. We have Representative Anderson.
Yeah, just that question. Before we started the meeting, maybe Senator Seekins could just take a brief moment on the record. Another concern I had from the medical community was the rate freezing, and just briefly, if you could put that on the record, because I know you worked on that. Does that go away or disband, or do we have to wait for the medical review committee? I think I know the answer, but just to get it reiterated one more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ralph Seekins, District D. As I understand the question, through the chair, if you all look at the section 80, yeah, section, wait a second here, let me get find it.
Section 75.
Section 75 of the bill on page 48. You'll notice that there's a repealer there. A repealer factor that says AS 2330-097-A1 is repealed August 1st, 2007. And if you go back then to page 25, you'll find 097-A1. And what we did here was we said we have this medical services review board that's to look at the medical compensation process, to take a look at what the guidelines would be and what the compensation would be. And we froze the medical payment section now as of the December 1st, 2004 bulletin, published December 1st, 2004. So they're at the current rate that we're paying right now. That's the 2005 rate. If by the end of our 2007 session, we have not revised the medical process, we're anticipating we would do that from the input from the Medical Services Advisory Board. This section is repealed, and we go back to the original method that the board is currently using to calculate medical rates. So there is a drop-dead rate date. If we don't act to put something else in place, we go back to the old system.
Just through the chair, so this is the physicians, I think, are trying to help solve this workers' compensation
right.
problem by doing this, but
yes.
They're like, hey, after 2 years, if you don't have an agreement, please
right.
don't freeze them forever.
And I put this repealer in the Judiciary Committee on the Senate side because we did agree. If you remember, the governor suggested freezing these rates at 1999. There was then the conversation about making that December 1st, 2004. We decided if we were going to freeze it, and we talked with the docs about this, we talked with many of the associations, and said if we were going to freeze the rates, we'd freeze them at the current rate, which is really a freeze for 1 year, because if you look at when it's established, And if we haven't acted by the end of our session, plus the 90-day normal effective date that we look at, that's how we calculated that date, then it goes back to the old system.
Representative Croft?
Just, I know we're about to put this out. I don't want to belabor the point, but what's your idea, Senator Seekins, of where the government gets the authority to set rates between private employers, employees, and doctors on what they can charge for their services, whether temporarily or frozen at 99 or 2005? What's our source of that authority?
It's in statute now. We do it now. The board sets it now. We've simply frozen it at this rate now and said that we will recalculate after this process takes place.
The board sets rates. You're not going to charge workers' compensation more than the market rate. So it's customary, traditional. I don't want you to charge me more than you charge anybody else. We're in a new territory to say, here's what you have to.
But Chair, I disagree. Medicaid, Medicare, it's not an uncommon thing for when government pays, government sets the rates.
And this is all done under a government construct, a government system.
Yes, it's not a new concept at all. It's been around as long as I can remember.
And you're comfortable with it?
I'm comfortable with that, yes.
Representative Roper?
On that point, just for the sake of it, there is annual review of the rates paid now, currently. Is that right? And I think it came about from a statutory change, and I don't know if I might have even been the author of that. I just got to double check. Is that correct?
For the record, I don't think I've spoken before. I am Paul F. Lasanke, the Division Director and Workers' Comp within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development through the Chair. Representative Roepberg, you are correct that since the bill that you authored passed, I believe it was in 2000, the statutory authority that Senator Seekins just mentioned was amended to include the responsibility for the board to revisit the calculation of the fee cap at least once a year.
Which previous to that was less frequently, as I recall.
There were periods of more than a year between the recalculations. That's correct.
Just getting the plug in here.
Glad
guys
to help.
The back, remember that.
And if I can, Mr. Chairman, and if I can, to the point that Representative Anderson made, there's been a tremendous amount of help from the medical community on trying to find the right way to proceed with this process.
Yes, Senator, and I did have a copy of a letter distributed to folks that included the beginning text that you and I had worked on that led to the amendment today. Representative Roper, motion?
Mr. Chairman,
I move.
Interrupt. There's one small.
Senator French.
We talked about this earlier. There's one small amendment to page 24. On lines 17 and 18, there's a reference to the Alaska Chiropractic Association.
Oh, that's right.
My understanding is that there's no such entity, and that should read Alaska Chiropractic Society. So my amendment would be to change the word association on line 18 of page 24, delete association, and insert society.
Okay, that will be amendment number 12. Is there any objection?
Oh, I might want to amend it further, but no, I won't today.
I would agree.
Seekins, is your understanding that the correct reference for that group?
Yeah, yes, it is, Mr. Chairman. I do agree with that. I would tell you that was my intent all the time along, but I was a little clumsy in carrying it out.
Is there any objection to amendment number 12? Seeing none, that amendment is adopted. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the House Committee substitute. We already adopted a working document.
Conference Committee substitute.
Right, excuse me. Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt and move out the Conference Committee substitute for Senate Bill 130 as amended with the new adjusted fiscal notes.
I'll object.
There is objection. Speak to your objection.
The bill still contains an appeals commission, which, from my view, is a bureaucratic construct, which will not help in any way, as far as I can tell, do what the proponents of that idea are claiming. I ran a quick calculation this morning, and it's my estimation that we've been operating under the current system for at least 40 years. that if there are 30 decisions rendered per year from the Superior Court, that's 1,200 written decisions from the Superior Court on workers' comp cases. Out of that body of law, we've never been presented with one pair of decisions that are in conflict with one another. And so it strikes me that the Superior Court is working quite well right now to resolve these claims, resolving them consistently, resolving them in a court of law where most folks are going to want to get from the testimony that we've had from the court folks. So from my view, we're going to create a new bureaucracy and get very little from it. And therefore, I'm opposed to the Appeals Commission. And that's my objection.
Okay. We'll have a roll call vote on the passage of the conference committee bill.
Yes.
Senator French?
No.
Representative Roper?
Yes.
Representative
Bob? No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Yes. The conference CS will be reported out, and that concludes the meeting.
Gene, thank you.
Good job.
Yeah, good job, Gene.
Tough, whatever way you fall, good chairmanship.